Hey, Media People podcast listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love our newsletter, appropriately named the Media People Newsletter. Delivered right to your inbox, each edition is a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or go to mediapeople.behive.com. That's B-E-E-H-I-I-V. Thanks for listening to the Media People Podcast, lively and insightful chats with the people who power the media industry. I'm your host, Victor Genova. For more episodes, you can go to mediapeople.ca or subscribe wherever you get podcasts, including youtube.com/@mediapeoplepodcast. Views expressed by participants are personal. Cracking the media industry can be tough for an employee, but for an entrepreneur, building something from scratch can be a tall order. But it was a challenge that Sotero Bernardo was up for. Sotero is the co-founder, head of business development at Coastal Digital Group, an experience agency combining creativity with technology. The original goal was to make it in media sales, but sales opportunities are scarce when you're fresh out of school. So Sotero took a job as a junior media planner at Cassette Media, working on both the Nike and Sony PlayStation media accounts. He moved into venue advertising before networking his way to a sales role with Ideon Media. His success led to a promotion and expanded responsibilities that included managing people and acquiring new publisher representation deals. But Sotero saw an opportunity in the creative space, specifically with Rich Media. He had a plan to capitalize on this and co-founded Coastal Digital Group with his business partner. Sotero Bernardo stops by to chat about growing up in Toronto's Parkdale neighborhood, attending high school in suburbia, working at McDonald's, monetizing charisma lessons, his media sales career, and entrepreneurship in the ultra-competitive media space.
Coastal Digital Group is a creative advertising agency. I mean, we're pretty much like your traditional creative advertising agency, but we have expanded quite a bit. Where our primary focus when we first launched was on digital creative specifically, a lot of Rich Media, digital assets, stuff like that. But lately we had, during the pandemic, we had to expand our services. So that's kind of why I'm trying to coin this new term called an experience advertising agency, anywhere from augmented reality, even to ad ops, ad operations for hire is what we do. So strategy consulting. I don't ever want to be confused with one of those, like, you know, those people who say, oh, we do full service. We're a full service marketing agency, et cetera. It's not necessarily like that. I mean, we can get a little bit more into that, but my role as a co-founder and head of business development is to always constantly seek new clients, whatever their need may be. It's not necessarily like we need a retainer client to do everything, all the strategy, building assets, et cetera. It's anything from like those one-offs, like I mentioned, ad operations, creative design, from traditional assets to video photography. Rich Media is a big one for us. That's actually kind of why we launched the company to begin with. For some of my clients, I'm actually acting creative director and a strategy consultant, and I act on behalf of their agency. So it's kind of, there's no real way to sum up exactly what Coastal Digital Group is, but I hope I covered it.
Sotero, thank you so much for dropping by today. I'm looking forward to our chat. As always, we go back to the beginning. I had no idea that you were a Vancouver native.
Yeah, I actually was born there, but I was not really there for a long time. Just born there, not even enough to remember other than through pictures, but basically moved to Toronto when I was very young.
What brought the family to Toronto?
All right, we're going to be real here. Basically, my dad came from a large family. Had about 7 brothers and 7 sisters.
Said you had 7 brothers and 7 sisters, or is that your dad?
Yeah, my dad. So
those are a lot of aunts and uncles.
Those are it's typical Filipino. I mean, I wouldn't say typical, but a typical Filipino family back then. So he had 7 brothers, 7 sisters, and majority of his siblings decided to move to Vancouver. Big migration of Filipinos coming to Canada. Vancouver was their spot. He met my mom in the Philippines. They started dating and somehow both ended up in Vancouver. Got married quickly. And now my mother's side of the family were all based in Toronto. They migrated to Toronto at the same time. So my mom decided to say, hey, you know what? Let's give my family a try. And it kind of worked out better. And that's where I was raised.
And where in Toronto did the family move to first?
Parkdale specifically. So Literally 145 Jameson Avenue, the apartments there on Jameson and King. That's pretty much where I spent my childhood.
This is where you and I cross over a little bit because your teenage years, you spent them in Mississauga, and I'm a Mississauga boy.
Yes, I did go to Mississauga. I think it was primarily because, okay, so my parents were finally like apartment to apartment, just like all the other Filipino immigrants that come to Canada around that time. This was in the late 80s, I guess. And they wanted a house. Obviously, Mississauga was up and coming at the time. So they bought a townhouse in Mississauga. And we actually, believe it or not, I know I always see memes like this, but people are like, hey, back in my day, I used to live next to a farm. And we actually
Yes.
did. We did live next to a farm, like a giant farm had horses. As kids, we would go out and get carrots and feed these horses. And it was pretty crazy to see what it's like now. I think it's like the seventh largest city in Canada. So yeah, it was interesting.
It's home of what I call the three S's: shopping mall, schools, and subdivisions. Like, that's how you summarize Mississauga.
Correct. I agree. Yeah, they called it the burbs.
So what high school did you go to?
St. Francis Xavier.
Ah, okay. So you were kind of in that's in the Erin Mills area, right? Sort of, or more Meadowvale.
More, I don't know what you call it, Cooksville, like here, Ontario, or Highway 10, whatever they call it, and Bristol. I don't know if you're familiar with that area.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, right where it used to be called the Hershey Center. N
Kind of,
not
yeah.
kind of. Yeah, it's Paramount Food, Fine Food Center. So where the hockey arena was. No, I'm
Yeah,
very.
I
Yeah,
used to
just.
work there.
Okay. So yeah, just kind of a little bit northeast of Square One, because that's like the nucleus of Mississauga.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, so
Yeah.
you're a basketball fan, and to be a basketball fan in Canada in the 90s was a pretty big deal because we had the Raptors and the Grizzlies. So as a Vancouver boy now living in Toronto, Canada gets two NBA franchises. Who do you root for?
So I did root for Vancouver. Sharif Abdur-Rahim, Big Country. I mean, actually, Big Country is kind of when I stopped rooting for them. There was hype. I mean, like everyone else too, there was hype around him. But then he kind of ruined the franchise in a way. Like I just couldn't cheer for them anymore. They just kept losing. But Sharif Abdur-Rahim was like the, in my mind. I mean, obviously, I'm gonna root for Toronto too. Vince Carter and oh, sorry, Damon Stoudamire at the
Gonna
time.
say you got to go back to Damon Stoudamire, yeah.
So that
Junkyard
was
Dog.
cool. Yeah, all those guys, like that, it was great. But I mean, just because I was born, I mean, truthfully, I was just trying to be different. I didn't want to be like everyone else. So, and those Grizzly jerseys were pretty amazing.
Yeah, the 90s were all about
The
turquoise. It
original,
was
yeah.
the Grizzlies, the San Jose Sharks. You even had teams like the Islanders and the Pistons being like, give me some of that color as well.
Yeah.
How did you get into basketball? Like, why is that one of the things that were your interests or hobbies growing up?
Yeah, it's strange. Some people will tell you that it's just in the blood of Filipinos. You just have to like basketball. And you know what? I mean, if that is a real answer, then I would say it's because I'm Filipino. I mean, it's not like there was an influence in my childhood or anything like that, or like it was always on, like my dad was watching. None of that. It's just, I don't know what it is. I just had this whenever I saw people playing basketball, I just always wanted to play it. So that's why I'm going to go back to saying, like, I think it is in Filipino blood. But the problem is, I think, look, we're really good at basketball as Filipinos. We just lack that height, right? So otherwise, I think we would see a lot more Filipinos in the NBA. I don't know if you ever had a chance to watch Filipinos play, like in the, you've heard of these, like the Filipino rec leagues and stuff.
Okay, I'm actually somewhat familiar with the professional league in the Philippines for no other reason than they made an amazing mobile game years ago on Android, and I found it by accident in the Play Store, and I downloaded it, and I was just like, "Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "This is a fantastic game to play on your phone, and it's based on the league in the Philippines." So
Yeah,
that's how I
I know what
that's
you're
how I
talking
kind
about.
you know the game I'm talking about. That's how I
It
kind of got
does it
into
remind
it.
you of NBA Jam?
A little bit, yeah, that's what it was like. And I liked NBA Jam. I had that and TE on my Genesis.
Yeah. See. Okay. So yeah, I think I have the same game as you. Yeah,
Yeah.
but no, I, not necessarily the PBA that I'm kind of following. It's more so like there's all these like Filipino rep leagues. Sorry, rec leagues. Mississauga, Toronto. They call it FIBA. That's one of them, MPAA. Like, it's just like if you were Filipino and you didn't like basketball, then they would kind of isolate you and be like, oh, that's a weird kid. But yeah, so you kind of, but the thing was, I was never really good at it. So I just loved playing it.
You were also a bit of an artist. Is it right to say you were a bit of an artist, or you're into art? Because one of your other passions is drawing and painting. And then when you say digital art, do you mean like getting into Photoshop?
Photoshop, Illustrator, yeah. All the latest tools that you can use to make art these days. Haven't gotten into generative AI yet, but yeah, I did dabble quite a bit. I mean, whether you want to call it sketching or drawing as a skill, that's really what I was doing, to the point where I think a lot of my artwork, even when I was in grade two, I remember this, teachers were like so blown away. And I never really knew that I was quote unquote talented or anything like that. I just enjoyed doing it. And I would see something. I was really good at like replicating something with a pencil. That was like my go-to medium. I just needed a paper and a pencil, and I would take care of all the shading and everything. I never took any classes or anything like that. I was just one of those where I saw something I liked. I remember it was like the Ninja Turtles, the first time it came out, the real life version, not the cartoon.
Oh, that movie was fantastic.
Right?
Oh.
Yeah, it was a great movie. Like good drama in there too. But whenever I saw that, I'd actually hit pause on the, I'm dating myself here, but on the VCR, I'd hit pause. And for the longest time, I would just get a paper, watch Raphael, and then I would just sketch it out. And I loved it ever since. But the problem with that was, and I guess Filipinos will tell you too, their parents never really encouraged art as a career, let's just say. Always telling you like, oh, that's just a hobby. Like, yeah, you're really great at it. Like they'd love to brag about me to family, sure. Like, yo, pull out your art, show them your painting, show them your drawings during family parties, great. But then when I tell her, hey, mom, I think I want to go to like post-secondary school. I'm going to apply for all these art programs. And she's like, oh, don't waste your money on that. And I'm like, there's no career there. I'm like, okay. So she, you know, bless my mom, love her. But Filipino parents do not view art as a good career choice, let's just say.
Do you think it has something to do with them being immigrants? Because my parents, they're not immigrants, but they're first generation Canadians. And it's kind of the same thing as well, too. They look at that and go, they don't see a steady paycheck in it. And they kind of equate a steady paycheck with stability and stability with success. And not to speak for your parents, but they're probably looking at you and going, Sotero, we made this leap across the Pacific Ocean and then halfway across the country to give you an opportunity, again, for stability. I mean, a consistent paycheck and so forth. And they're looking at that going, we're going to give you all this opportunity and you might be doing something that you can't monetize. Like, do you think that had something to do with it? Like they looked at the risks or the sacrifices they had made and you were looking at a career that was full of sacrifices. Like it was basically feast or famine. You're either going to crush it or again, it gets relegated to a hobby.
That's exactly what it is actually. So I did have one of these like serious conversations after secondary school, after high school was done, I talked to my parents about like my passion for art and how I think I can make it a career. And then they kind of said exactly what you said. Like we came to this country, there's a certain way of doing things here, certain ways of being successful. And my parents were successful with their careers. My dad ended up retiring for working for the city of Toronto. So government job is kind of what we were supposed to aspire to. My mom was a nurse, just like every good Filipino woman who comes here to Canada. So they kind of had this vision for me to either get into some sort of government job or somewhere in the medical field. And yeah, I did actually end up there at some part of my career. Actually, before I got into marketing and advertising, I was at the hospital.
How many people listening to this know that one of your passions is cooking?
Probably maybe less than a handful.
How did you get into that?
I think a large influence is probably my dad. My dad is the one who cooks dinner at home. I would always just be in the kitchen there with him, just seeing like, what are you cooking today? What are you doing here? Can I help you? And it just, you know, watching shows like, I don't know if you remember Walk with Yan.
Oh God, Yan Can Cook, Walk with Yan, the urban peasant.
Yeah. That's because we didn't really have, you know, what do they call this today? Digital TV or TV on demand, we'll call it.
Yeah.
We just had to watch what was on our channels, our free cable channels at the time. So a lot of the cooking shows I would just watch and it was just always interesting to me. And then I started to try new foods and from different cultures. Growing up in Parkdale and having different, I guess, ethnicities of friends when I get invited to their homes. From German food to Somalian food, African food, like it was great. So I just had a passion for, I guess you'd call it eating. And in order to eat great food, you got to learn how to cook it too, because it's going to be expensive just going out all the time. So yeah, I kind of took that up as a side hobby on my own. And yeah, I've been cooking ever since. And now with the internet, oh, it's amazing. There's nothing that I can't learn to cook in a way. So.
Are you the type of person that's always saving and archiving Instagram or TikTok cooking videos? Because if I see something that I want to do, I'm like, you know what? I'm saving this for later. And then when I do get the time, I'll buy the ingredients and take a chance at it.
I am actually not only that is my so there's a what do they call it, like a not a playlist, but in your saved folder, I do add all the Instagram recipes that I see there. But mostly I go as far as actually, because I don't want to keep save on your Instagram and then you just never review these things anymore. I actually do make an effort to, like, when I get to like 10 recipes that I save, I actually go out, get the recipe, I mean get the groceries and make it, and to the point where I'm putting it in my calendar and sending to my wife saying, this is what we're going to eat tonight. So that's kind of how I treat Instagram. But YouTube is also like, YouTube is like my go-to.
Likewise, I always ask my guests who their influencers were growing up. And most people will reference a family member or maybe an athlete, but you picked your father. But before we talk about your dad, let's talk about the two fictional characters, not the actors portraying them, the two fictional characters. So we've got Zach Morris and Will Smith, in air quotes, as the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So why those two?
Okay, this is an interesting one. So Saved by the Bell was big, obviously, when we were growing up, and not many TV shows like that that have those kind of characters in that cast, at least in the daytime, that we were allowed to watch as kids. And then Fresh Prince was more of a treat that our family would let us watch. It's a funny show, it's wholesome, for the most part, maybe not of as of 2024 culture, but at the time it was great. So obviously, the lead characters. This basically had, when I say an influence, these two, it was when I started to get interested in the other gender, females, girls, if you will. So I was like, you know what? What kind of personality do girls like? And then I don't have many frames of reference other than television and what we watch, and then my family and other friends and stuff. So I was really into Saved by the Bell and Fresh Prince, and I kind of tried to create this personality of like both of them combined. Like, how can you be charming, nice, funny, and cool all at the same time? And then I kind of made it my own in that way. So it really, the influence there, I guess, or the reason that I've chosen those two was to basically impress girls. I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's what I was trying to do.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you need some sort of charm to work a crowd and to get through life. And those two guys definitely. Did you have the large cell phone that Zach Morris had? Because that's the one thing that sticks out when we watch the old Saved by the Bell episodes, is that he's just carrying this thing the
The
size of his
brick.
forearm, the brick,
Yeah.
and putting it in his locker and everything. Like, he was kind of foreshadowing what high school was going to be like 20 years from then, but
Yeah.
it wasn't going to be like that though with those.
No. But the phone, the brick phone, yeah. So I was pretty happy. I don't know how. I don't even know. Like, my dad did work for the city of Toronto for like the longest time. So during that time too of Saved by the Bell, he was still at the city. He just kept getting new tech. Every time tech came out, I don't know, sometimes it would come in a garbage bag from one of his friends. I don't want to question how that came about, but like, I all of a sudden, like when the first Apple Mac computer came out, he had it. It came out of a garbage bag again. Some of his friends came by, and I'm like, "Oh, what is this?" He's like, "Oh, this is called a computer." It's like, amazing. So he came home one time with the brick phone, and I love that thing. I really thought I was Zach Morris, right? I would take it to school. I wasn't supposed to, but I would take it just to look cool, like Zach. And I thought it was the coolest thing at the time. So the brick phone, yeah, I wish I could have one now, just as a prop to have around to show my kids, like, hey, you don't know what a phone really was back then.
You've mentioned your father. Why do you cite him as being one of your influences?
I mean, he was basically the male presence in my life, day to day, to this day. So just watching him, I mean, and I mentioned about the cooking, how that kind of got me into cooking, anything he would do. I guess I really looked up to him, not only for his advice in terms of his career and seeing how much of a work ethic this man has. I would never not see him working, but he always did have time for us when he wasn't working. He just kind of dedicated it to us, which was great. But to see him grind so much and to have the life that we did have growing up. I mean, even as immigrant parents, like we weren't supposed to be quote unquote like the rich ones and stuff like that. So I didn't really notice any of that though growing up. So I did admire it quite a bit. Not only did he have his steady full-time job, but sometimes this guy would always have like part-time jobs, even like delivering papers at 4 a.m. when he started work at the city of Toronto down on King there at like 9 a.m. But he was always constantly hustling to the point where he even started his own side business, I guess you'd call it, delivering frozen meats and seafood to the local Parkdale community. I even helped him out with that. I just found that so interesting. Like everything this guy would do is just kind of something I looked up to. And I said one day, like, hopefully I can be as good as him, if not better, and then kind of take care of everyone else as they age.
Your very first job was at McDonald's. What did you learn about yourself working for a quick service restaurant?
So McDonald's, I have a deep love, I guess, for McDonald's being my first job from that point of view. I mean, the training there was amazing. I'm going to say it's amazing only because I am comparing it to people of today and what I see the staff at McDonald's of today, not even just today, like over maybe the last 10 years. Maybe I'm becoming a cranky old man. I don't know. But I have seen the quality drop. I have seen a lot of less care of people at McDonald's of today. So I don't know if the training program has changed, but they taught me quite a bit in terms of work ethic and structure and following rules and efficiency and promotions and how people move up. And I learned even from the, I think it was whoever owned that franchise at the time, can't remember his name, but I even got a chance to talk to him and learned a little bit about his side of the business and what it entails. So I was always curious as to like how things work, I guess the economics of it all. And McDonald's actually was a decent place to learn all of that. But yeah, and obviously like a lot of my high school friends were there too. So it made it a great time. But some of the perks that they offered at McDonald's, I don't know if they still do, but they have this thing called Brower, which is like, I guess when you do the stock, but it's not necessarily a shift, like a normal shift that they would do there, either the kitchen or the cash or whatever. So you would come in on your own time to do the stock whenever the truck came, and they would reward you not only with pay, obviously, but they would reward you with a free meal. Obviously, I'm 16. I'm like, yo, I get a big free, like expensive meal. So I would always say yes. So after a while, though, like a couple of months into this, I was just their go-to, one of their go-to guys. It was a team of three that needed to do the stock to do this Brower stock job because I loved getting those free meals. But then I started to get a little, what's the political correct word here? I was gaining a little bit of weight now. I just started noticing. I'm like, hey, these pants are getting a little bit tight now. Maybe it's because of all the free Big Macs and Big Extras I keep eating here. I'm thinking like, hey, I'm young, you know, it's fine. But yeah, not the healthiest.
What was your go-to meal there?
It was the Big Extra, believe it or not. And I was there for, they never canceled at the time. Like they had it the whole time. So I wasn't one of those who never got to experience it. But yeah, the Big Extra, it was something they did with their seasoning. It was a lot different. It was like they included like salt and black pepper. And it wasn't the regular burger that you get of today. But yeah, it was a Big Extra, definitely.
Let's talk about your time at Humber College. Because when we were putting this together and we were doing some pre-production work, something stood out to me. You referred to yourself as the Van Wilder of Humber College. So take me, because that means you had to have been there for probably longer than the duration of a diploma program there. So take us through how long you were there and how many different programs you were enrolled in before you landed on advertising media sales from which you graduated from.
Like every other good high school kid out there during that time, I applied for post-secondary and decided to do a fail-safe. I don't know. Everyone always talks about marketing this, marketing that. It's like kind of the easy option if you're kind of unsure of what you're going to do in life. So I did end up going there, Humber North Campus for marketing. Did that program, but honestly, I think I was just too young to kind of want to start, oh, let's get into the career now. Let's start working 9 to 5. I just wanted to have a good time. So once I finished the 2-year program at Humber for marketing, I said, okay, let me take a break. Let me work full time somewhere and get some life experience and then think about going back to school again. That lasted for a semester. And I said, you know what? I don't really like working. Let's go back to school. Maybe further my experience from marketing that I got and go into design and media foundation, because I'm going to tell my mom, you know what, here's the time I'm going to prove to you that I can make something of this. And that's when like Adobe Illustrator and Adobe Photoshop were kind of becoming like more mainstream, not necessarily only for graphic designers. So dabbled in that program, enjoyed that thoroughly. And yeah, so that was over at Humber North as well. But all this time, I have been putting, every time I apply for post-secondary programs, I've been putting advertising media sales there as an option. Didn't take it though until, and I don't necessarily mean Van Wilder from just Humber. I actually have gone to George Brown too to do a food and nutrition course, which actually that's how I ended up working at the hospital after taking that course. My passion for cooking as well, I was trying to figure out if I was going to do something there. So I did a short stop at George Brown after the Design and Media Foundation program, mainly also because I wasn't ready again to quote unquote grow up and just be that adult of working a 9-to-5 job. So finally, I was at, I finished at George Brown, ended up working at Trillium Hospital in Mississauga, just on the Queensway in here, Ontario. Got into the kitchen of the food and nutrition side of the business, was doing great over there, was still just, something was just missing there. I mean, like when you're going to like planning menus for oncology patients, getting to know some of these people that you kind of see on a daily that are there, and you know what oncology is, right? Like you're kind of dealing with cancer, mm-hmm. Or even palliative care. You get to know these people. And at the time, I think it was like 23 or 24, and it was just a depressing place to be because I would get close with some of these patients, and then next thing you know, I'm like, hey, where'd so and so go? And they passed. And I was like, you know, this is becoming a little depressing for me. So I'm like, yeah, let's see what I could do if I go back to post-secondary and see what I can do there. Turns out I didn't do that right away because school became pretty expensive all of a sudden, not what I remembered. And I didn't want to do the whole OSAP thing again, student loans. I wanted to kind of bootstrap it myself. So what I did over the summer, my friend and I, and this kind of goes back to my influence of Zach Morris and Fresh Prince. So I like to go clubbing. Do they call it clubbing now? Probably not.
I don't know what they call it
right?
Anymore.
There's no term for that, but it used
but
to be.
But do kids even
clubbing.
Go out anymore? Like, that's the thing. Or do they just get into their phones and make digital communities that way? Like, I don't know.
Hey, man, I hope people still see each other in real life, but who knows? But back then, going to nightclubs was a thing, and I thoroughly enjoyed that during those times. So my friend thought, he's like, you know what? You're pretty successful, like, talking to girls. Do you ever think about teaching that? And I'm like, you know what? That's nothing I would, you know, have you heard of, what's that guy's name? The Game?
No, but you know what came to mind when you brought it up? It was ironically a Will Smith movie.
Hitch.
Is it Hitch? That's the one, Hitch.
Yeah. So, I mean, the business that we did end up starting during that summer before I went back to school was similar to Hitch. I'd say similar more to Hitch than any other like pickup artist school or anything like that. First of all, I never thought this would go anywhere. I never thought anyone was going to listen to us. No one was going to pay for to hear me speak or anything like that. But we did quite well to the point where I did end up paying for my school, advertising media sales from this little side gig that we did. It paid for a couple of trips to Vegas. I don't know. It was a great time. But yeah, the influence there was, if I had to break down the science of kind of courting women or speaking to the other gender without fear, I referenced my quote-unquote childhood watching Zach and Fresh Prince, and I took the good of like the good qualities of these guys and these characters, and I kind of said, all right, let's put this into everyday life. And at the end of the day, I think I was just more so trying to teach men how to socialize with women and not necessarily in, like, I never did one of those. Have you heard of the term negging or anything like that?
No, I'm unfamiliar with that.
Yeah. So like negative compliments. I don't know. Like there was this notion back then that if you treated, or if you were a bit of an a-hole like to women, when you speak to them, it's kind of an attractive trait. Definitely wasn't teaching any of that kind of stuff. And I was more so trying to just teach men that women are people too. It's not hard to speak to them if you just don't come at it from an aggressive creepy way. So those were, so it's not necessarily like a pickup artist school, but that's why I'm saying, like, I think what I was doing was more teaching men how to socialize with the other gender. And then that kind of turned into, all right, I made a decent amount of money at that time from that little side business, to the point where I'm like, how can I take this now, the skill set of socializing with people, and make a real like career out of it? And then that's where I started reading again. I was like, you know what, let me read. Something keeps bringing me back to advertising media sales program. And I read it again. I'm like, you know what, this is exactly what I do actually on this little side business that I have. So I'll still work at the hospital while going to school, Humber Advertising Media Sales, and then we'll see where it goes from there. And then here I am today.
We're going to take a quick break. Enjoying this episode? Of course you are, or you wouldn't have made it this far. Compliment your listening experience by subscribing to the Media People newsletter at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or at mediapeople.beehive.com. It's a mix of original and curated content designed to feed your curiosity while aiding in personal development. On top of more podcasts, we'll connect you with articles, interviews, and industry events. Subscribe at mediapeople.ca/newsletter or mediapeople.beehive.com.
And your first job out of graduation, you must have been over the moon to be hired by Cassette, but not just because it's Cassette, but your first clients were Nike and Sony PlayStation. At this point, you're what, 24, 25?
No, I'm a little bit older here.
Okay, let's say even you're 26. You've got to be looking at that and going, because something I've learned from my peers in the agency world, and I've never worked agency side, no disrespect to the agencies, that's part of the attraction to working there, but it's really the clients and the work that you get to do with those clients and the brands. That's what really drives excitement.
To be honest with you, I had no idea what the real, I really wanted to get into sales, period. So I was looking more into media sales places, out of home places like Bell or Patterson, because digital wasn't really a big thing at that time. So when I had the opportunity to interview at Cassette, I just didn't even know what I was going to be working on or anything like that. Like I found out only after I signed the contract that I'd be on Nike and PlayStation. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Obviously PlayStation more than Nike for some reason. But yeah, it was just interesting, very exciting, but it was more so, I didn't realize that Cassette at that time was viewed pretty highly. They were, if I can compare, who I always tell this to people when I was there, if you look at people from Cassette at these media parties, when they walk into the group, because apparently they don't always go out, they get invited to every single thing, which was great for my career in terms of networking, because I always said yes. But the OGs of Cassette, they would not always come out to these parties. But when they did, they reminded me of the Cullen family from Twilight. Like, you know,
oh,
that
scene?
Yeah,
yes,
you know that scene when they walk in at first and Bella's first look, Kristen Stewart's like looking at.
Is this in the cafeteria?
Family. Yes, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, you know the one I'm talking about. That I is, know what you're talking about.
That's all I see when the Cassette OGs come to a party and I'm like, oh my God, they're here. And then they slow-mo in my mind. They're walking into the party. I'm like, oh, they came. And other people too. So I'm like, oh, is that the Cassette people? I'm like, oh my God. Like, I was like, I'm one of the Cassette people, but I guess I haven't done my time. But yeah, it was great to work at Cassette as a first job, knowing that my goal was to inevitably be on the sales side, because it was great. Like a lot of people, like I said, the Cassette was invited to everything. So I just kind of started to build my network at all of these events, being viewed more so as a fellow agency person. So when the time came, the transition was a little bit easier to get meetings and, you know, rather than starting right away in sales.
Did you find yourself taking notes on how the sales professionals interacted with you? Like, would you go over a prospect email and be like, oh, that's not bad, or this is crap, I would never send anything like it, or the way they would present their products in presentations and so forth?
Yeah. So I didn't necessarily take away anything from them. It's probably the second part of what you said. I would notice certain things that I should not do. Like I would make notes of on that, like certain behavior characteristics that I saw on certain reps. Some of them, I don't know, there was just a lot of inappropriateness at certain times, but I think that was just me being new to this style of work and not realizing that, oh, okay, you can be a little bit more relaxed. Oh, I understand now what building rapport means. I know like Humber College, specifically Barb and Donna, they did prep me on what to expect, but I had no idea until I actually was in it. But I did take away, I guess, some good characteristics from those reps who did stand out. To this day, we're still pretty tight. I think you always do remember your first ad sales rep that you really like got along with, or even the first one that took you out. Like when I say out, I mean like on a boozy lunch, or like a lunch that turned into, oh my God, it's 6 o'clock, it's time to go home. You do remember those guys. But what I do take away from them is like their ability to just be so personable and establish that rapport right away. That's kind of like what I like to do that in general. So it's good to see that like I can be myself and make money out of this, make a career out of it.
And you don't get it from all sales reps. Like, let's put this out here. You mentioned you were in an entry-level position at Cassette, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of sales professionals pay attention to the people in the entry-level jobs, not until they're up another notch or two. And I think that's a bad thing to do, to kind of pick and choose who you're going to want to work with, because you should be embracing the entire team. You were one member of many people working on Nike and PlayStation, and I know that there are some sales professionals out there that would be like, I'm going to take your boss out. And then your boss has to fight and say, no, can we bring the rest of the team with us and so forth? But yeah, that's what I find with some sales professionals, is that they kind of pick and choose rather than just trying to wrap their arms around the entire industry.
Yeah, that might be, I'm going to call it like the old dinosaur way of doing things, right? We were just taught, I mean, those are those like, you know, sales guys through and through, where let's go find the decision makers and only want to talk to them, right? Like
the decision makers. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. But it's not easy to navigate that. But, and you know that our industry, I call it, it is a young industry, right? Like, you know, you have people fresh out of college, fresh out of college and, getting into these multi-million dollar plans, but inevitably, like even if they are juniors, they're gonna move up. So like, and you as a salesperson are gonna kind of not stay the same, but essentially like you're still in sales, so you're getting older, but your clients are getting staying the same age, and you kind of have to respect everybody in that sense. And inevitably they are going to be in a position of power, or quote-unquote a decision maker. So you know, I mean, just be kind all around.
Would you say that KB Media, your next move, that was your first opportunity to jump into sales?
That, I wouldn't say, that was more, I guess, relationship skill building. It was venue management position. So it was an out-of-home company that had the resto bar type of boards in the washroom ads, like the ones that you see over urinal. They call them urinal ads, but I didn't want to like, you know, make it sound
no
like
that's
bad.
What they are what they are, man.
Yeah, so the urinal ads, like I got to meet a lot of the dive bar owners and nightclub owners and restaurants, and just establishing that rapport and building relationships with those guys, it allowed me to just build on my sales skill set. So but that was more of a short stint. It was a little bit weird. I did that not knowing what the position was, because it was a contract position and it wasn't very specific on what the job entailed. I thought it was going to be sales from the description that I read, and it wasn't. But, you know, that's why I kind of, was only there for a short amount of time. I tried to keep that job because I thought I could do it part time. It's just like going to venue and making sure everyone's happy, the boards are good, swap out some client assets from time to time. But I knew I needed to get into a digital role early on. And that's when I remembered Kevin Bartis from Ideon Media. He came to present to Cassette. And I was impressed with him, just how easy he was to talk to. His rep that was there at the time, not so much. But yeah, I said, funny enough, it was because of that rep and my interaction with him. I thought to myself, you know what? I think I could do his job. And not to sound like arrogant or anything, but I just felt like, you know what? This guy did not carry himself very well. My boss at the time, like I said, didn't like their vibe and everything, but Kevin was different. I just said, you know what? Let me grab a coffee with this guy, see if he's hiring, see what the business is all about, just to learn a little bit, you know, because I'm now used to just hitting up strangers, which coming from like working at a hospital and then switching that, and just now your job is to engage with strangers, basically. wasn't easy. So I finally spoke to him, and it turned out there wasn't really a position opening, but I think we just got along so well that the rest is kind of history in that sense. I was one of the OGs, I'll call it, OG sales reps at Ideon Media.
And so that was your first taste of sales, being an account manager there, right?
Yes. And it was great. At one point, without trying to say any names, I won't say any names, but at one point it was just me and the coordinator. And that was it. That was the entire company. So it was very startup mentality at that time, which also was brand new to me. I'm coming from Cassette, a very well-established business, and then going to Ideon Media, which I didn't know where it was going to go. But I kind of liked that in a sense, because he did trust me to the point where he gave me free rein, and free rein in the sense of you kind of, I'm just going to try to sum it up quickly, but if you feel that there is a need or demand in the digital space, when you're talking to clients out there, you let me know, and maybe we will build a product out of it. Maybe we will contact a new, because it was a rep firm, primarily just a rep firm, but we never built content or anything like that. So it just expanded. I just felt like I was a part of that growth. And I mean, I still talk to Kevin to this day, so we're still pretty tight. But yeah, it was just such a good start to my sales career.
I like what you mentioned there about the sort of startup mentality, and there were very few people there, and that if you wanted something, you had to do it yourself. Because I've worked at startups, I've worked with small companies, and I've worked with large companies. And some people really like working at big companies where everything is done for you. Or if you need something, you put a request in, fill out a form, and then eventually they get it to you. Whereas at a small company, it's like, if you want something done, you have to do it yourself. And it seemed like you thrived in that environment.
It's kind of like my personality too. Like, maybe it has to do with procrastination, like that part of it as well, where I like being under pressure and having to react quickly. It's weird, but I'm not one of those who, if I have something I'm tasked with that I need like 2 weeks preparation time and this and that, I'd rather just be thrown in the fire and figure it out. So that, at my time at Ideon Media allowed me to do that. Like, I really enjoyed getting like, Kevin, it was great. He did trust me to the point of like speaking directly with new potential publishers and trying to close them, which was also a different side of the business, right? Like, that wasn't just agency sales and talk to your network and sell them on something. This was more, now I was just getting into the nature of his business, right? I remember we were the first ones to, and Kevin, bless him, he used ComScore, found this mail property site called Complex, Complex Media, you know, the guys who are...
Oh, very familiar with Complex, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So didn't know who they were at the time. I did see on ComScore at the time they were over at like 600,000 unique visitors. I'm like, okay, this is something to look at. To the point where we set up a meeting, just a shot in the dark here, to see if we could meet with the vice president of sales and the CEO of Complex in New York. So Kevin and I flew down, and my job was basically to show them that I am Complex, like I am the Complex guy. So I'd be a perfect fit, because these guys were very New York, right? Like, I'm not going to name the names, but like the guys in charge at that time were very, very New York. So when I say New York, they're like, as soon as I walked in there, what kind of shoes are you wearing? Oh, where's that sweater from? I'm like, wow, okay. New York, but also, I guess, what do you call the word? Pretentious or bougie?
Bougie, posh.
Preppy. Yeah, yeah. But in a cool swag kind of way, like, because, you know, they were representing the male entertainment lifestyle brand Complex, and they just wanted to make sure I was a good fit. So we actually, I mean, they did enjoy who I was. They believed me. They're like, do you think you could sell? Like, it was a weird interview or an interview. Just saying, like, do you believe you're Complex and you can sell Complex to other people in Canada? Because they at the time they were like, thought, oh, how cold is it up there? And are there actual igloos? And I'm like, no, not at all. But that was normal back then. But yeah, that was one of my most favorite times, actually, was going down with Kevin. And basically from that one interview, I guess we did bring them to Canada. We represented them, and I think it went well. I mean, they were still there at Ideon when I departed, but I knew, I heard in the news, like, it became like BuzzFeed and acquisition after acquisition. But yeah, it was great. I mean, we even had meetings, because Mark Echo at the time, I think, was one of the main shareholders, if not the creator of Complex. Are you familiar with Mark Echo? You must have seen the Rhino sweaters, right? Back in the
day? No, I'm completely unfamiliar with that.
Okay, so you know those hoodies that you saw back when we were younger? It was like, it said Echo, E-C-K-O,
oh, okay, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Rhino.
Okay, when you say Echo, yeah, that. So he's the gentleman who founded that company?
Yeah, he did. So he started Complex, and it was really cool. I ended up meeting him because I was a fan of his just from the fashion point of view, right? Like everyone was rocking Echo at that time. So I thought that was really cool that I could kind of meet this guy and bring him to other clients here in Toronto. And so I don't know. I really enjoyed the acquisition process of Complex Media. And you know what? Funny thing is, Hot Ones, you know the show Hot Ones?
No, I don't know Hot Ones. Jeez, I must be living under a rock.
Well, you do know it. The spicy chicken wings that celebrities go on and interview. And
oh, is that with Zach Galifianakis?
Nope, that's Between Two Ferns. But okay. Hot Ones is with Sean Evans.
Okay, I am familiar with this one. Yes, I know what you're talking about. I didn't know it was called Hot Ones, but I see it pop up on social media every once in a while.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, to the point where they even say, oh, you want a little pre-roll spot. It's $2 million a spot. I'm like, wow, okay. You guys got really big. But the funny thing is I met Sean Evans when he was just one of the writers before they even started this thing called Complex TV. I met him as a normal guy, and he told me about this idea that they had, which was Hot Ones today. So I was like blown away just to see ideas and people flourish. And I mean, I applaud that. It's amazing that I kind of was there when he was just talking about this idea, because he was like, hey, I just want to know, what do you think of this? You think people in Canada will like it? I'm like, okay, there's that American thing again. But I was like, no, the concept itself is great. Like watching people suffer, eating hotter and hotter sauces. And I don't know, look what it turned into today. It's like massive today, right? So,
well, they're not just eating the wings and the sauces, but they're also trying to carry on a conversation, and you're just kind of watching them fall apart while mm-hmm. they do it.
Yeah.
Okay, so Kevin obviously rewarded your hard work and promoted you to the director of sales and new business. So how did your responsibilities change?
If anything, it just added a little bit more to my plate. Like other companies, I assume, other sales side companies, the director of sales still has to maintain his territory. But my role turned more into of like a, I don't want to call it like a closer or anything like that. But like if my sales reps were having trouble getting meetings with other people, I would kind of step in and say, hey, can I just help them out, basically booking meetings. I would help them out with presentations. I would go with them, whether it be in Toronto or Montreal or Vancouver. So it did take a lot of my time in that sense, but while still maintaining my own territory. But also, I think at that time when that happened, I also had my first child. So balancing that as well. I mean, thank God my wife, she's the greatest. She just not puts up with me, but she allowed myself to flourish in this career. I actually met her in the industry too. So she kind of understood it versus like some of my other friends and their girlfriends, they're talking like, hey, if you ever did what Sotero does, like we probably wouldn't be together. I'm like, wow. Okay. He's like, he's basically taking girls on dates. Like, I'm like, no, it's not like that at all. See what I mean? Like, so if you're not from this industry, like you kind of don't get it, or at least the sales, corporate sales industry. Other people don't get what we do, and they just think it's like a big party that full of drugs and alcohol. And it's not. It's relationship building to me.
I had a family member years ago who just did not know what I did for a living. And I finally had to pull up one of the websites we looked after when I was at Astral Media, the old Astral. And I pulled up Virgin Radio, and I'm like, see, they're pointing to a 300 by 250. And I'm like, you see that? He's like, yeah. I go, I sell that. And he just couldn't grasp it. He's like, well, how many of them do you sell? And it's just like, oh boy. And it's funny because if you don't understand the metrics of a CPM and you tell someone, I sold 2 million of those last week, not realizing that the CPM was like 10 bucks. So you really, it was only 5 grand you've secured. They're looking at you like you're a baller. Oh, you sold 2 million of those? Oh, take the rest of the year off. It's like, no, that's not the case. But no, I'm with you. People have a hard time understanding what we do for a living unless they're inserted into the actual industry and they've got experience. So things are going well at Ideon Media, but an opportunity to join Media Nation Corp presents itself. Was it because you've spoken very highly of Kevin Bartus, who's going to be a future guest, by the way, on this podcast, just to throw here. Yeah, him and I have been in discussions about it, and we've got a recording date booked. So he's coming up after this one drops. But
beautiful. Get ready for that one.
I'm looking forward to it. Him and I have been talking about this since last December, going back and forth about it. So we finally got it hammered down. But
Please make sure, though, that you get his unfiltered opinion. He is amazing.
You know what? I've never had much contact with Kevin apart from email and the odd LinkedIn message, but everyone I've spoken to have said that he is very good at being honest, and we like honesty on this podcast.
Yep.
But things are going well. Like, you've spoken very highly about working with Kevin. You're signing new deals. You're now running the sales team. So what was so attractive about this opportunity with Media Nation Corp that you decided to make the jump?
I did see it as an opportunity to test yet another startup to see if I could be successful there. Because at that point, I was thinking in my head, all right, we're talking about honesty here, so I'll be honest. I thought to myself, all right, I'm making someone a lot of money, because he did show me, and I understand the profit margin, the P&Ls and all that. And I'm like, okay, I understand the business. It's great. But I could be making so much more, I guess. I'm starting the prime or peak of my career. So like, how can I really maximize my working hours, my working time? So I thought to myself, all right, I've done a successful job at this company here. Let me see what I can do for another one, essentially a startup. If I can see success there within a year, then I'm going to bite the bullet and try it on my own.
Oh, so it was kind of like a dry run for Coastal Digital Group.
In a way, not necessarily Coastal Digital Group, like the idea of it, but more so from just the point of view of can I run a business on my own? Like whatever that business may be, obviously it was going to be in the marketing advertising space, but like the idea of Coastal Digital Group wasn't solidified or wasn't planned out or anything. It was more so just literally the business aspect of like, I'm understanding the intricacies and the necessary roles to run a business in the media space, in marketing and advertising. So can I actually go out, do it again with somebody else? And then I think it's time. Like I had been talking to my wife about it this whole time, even when I was at Ideon, saying like, I kind of want to do this on my own, right? Like, it seems like a lot of fun. And I'm not going to say it was like a pit stop, but it was a test. I used Media Nation as a test for myself.
Okay, so you're at Media Nation. At what point do you start to get the idea for Coastal Digital Group? Because you already knew that entrepreneurship was in your future. You were already letting that thought simmer. But when do things start to come together and you start to see more of a formalized company?
One of the guys I used to work with, he was on the ad operations side. He's my business partner today, but we've always been in touch. Even when I departed, we parted ways. We've always been in touch, and we knew someday we were going to work together. We just didn't know what we were going to do. So we would constantly talk and talk. We'd meet up every now and then throughout, like since I've left him. And we've always had this idea that like we wanted, like media sales was great, but in a way it was kind of like it lacked creativity, right? We were always kind of held to what the creative agency was going to give us, and we couldn't do anything really that cool. So we thought to ourselves, all right, you know what? It was our experience with Complex, actually. Complex was just blasting out custom unit after custom unit using a creative management platform called Seltra at that time. And Seltra, think of it as like a drag and drop Photoshop for rich media ads. So at that time, we were like, you know what? Like, we gotta do something in this space. I don't know when, I don't know where. So I tried to actually bring that up to Media Nation and see if like, hey, can we start kind of like a creative offering? I mean, nowadays you see every media vendor's like, oh yeah, we do creative, blah blah blah, right? Like, we can do rich media, we can do whatever you need. But back in that day, that time, there was no real like creative rich media offering. So I tried to bring it up to Media Nation and say, hey, why don't we make this a little bit of a business? I'll put together a business plan for you to look at, review it, and then let me know if you think this is going to be profitable. It didn't go the way I wanted to at Media Nation. And the reason why I brought it up to Media Nation, because I was still a little bit scared to kind of take that leap and do it myself, right? I kind of wanted somebody else to fund it, and then I would have, you know, decent amount of share in that venture. But didn't work out. So I told Brendan, my partner of today, said, you know what? I think it's time. Let's meet. Let's actually create this business plan that I kind of loosely started already. What do you think of it? And then all of a sudden, we started Coastal Digital Group in 2017.
What was the conversation like with your family leading up to it? Because prior to launching Coastal Digital Group, you had a very successful sales career, and that can be very lucrative if you're successful. And now you're you're kind of taking a step back. And I imagine part of those conversations were the money that I was making before could be even greater, but there's going to be this period where it's not as lucrative as it was. I know I'm kind of beating around the bush with it, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no. So it was scary, actually. It did work out, though. So, I mean, during that time of me and my partner kind of just fleshing out this business plan, I was actually in the process of buying one of these new build townhomes in Toronto. And I thought, you know what? Okay. Maybe if I sell this townhouse before it's even registered as a, you know, it was one of the new builds. I don't know if you're familiar with how those work.
We're talking about it's the title you're selling.
Yes. Sorry. It was the title. Yeah. So what I talked to my wife and said, hey, our realtor is telling us that the property that we purchased is really in high demand. And if we wanted to, we could probably sell it and make quite a decent profit. So it was a big conversation to have because we were also expecting another child at that time. She was already born. My mistake. Sorry, Hazel. She was just born. And, you know, you have a 3-year-old and a newborn. So trying to venture off on your own is very scary without any kind of cushion. I mean, I had savings, but it wasn't enough to say, hey, let's just stop making money for a little bit and see if this works. So long story short, we did end up selling that home. And we used the profits, like half to kind of fund this venture. And then the other half was just to, you know, live personal day-to-day bills, food, et cetera. So my wife, though, she believed in me, as she should. I'm a decent person, I think. So I had the drive, I had the ambition, I had the goal, I had the plan. So she just said, you know what, I trust you, go for it. I mean, worst case, obviously, I'm like, we can watch our finances. And if it's going to deplete to the point where, we're living, not even check to check, but we're just depleting our savings, then it's probably time to go and find a job. And I think at the time I was, like you said, my sales career was doing well. I did still have a decent network of clients, so I could always go back. If this failed in a year, I did tell my wife, I don't know why I always use this year mark, but I said, if this doesn't go well in over a year, I will stop it and go back to being a normal guy.
Were there any points within that year where you thought this might not work out? Or could you see progress on the horizon? And you kind of knew that I'm not even worried about what it's going to look like 6 months out, because we know that this is growing.
It was very scary the first 6 months. But, you know, we just kept plugging away at it and luckily we landed a retainer client. So that's when I started seeing, okay, just doing the math on its own, right? I'm like, the amount of work that we got to put into this client and the amount of the payout was enough for me to say, all right, let's keep going and let's go find another. So that did end up working out well, but then the bandwidth became a problem, right? There's only two of us, right? And it's not like I was doing a lot of the coding or designing or anything like that. I was still very much in charge of revenue generation. So we needed to hire somebody. And that to me is always scary because I'm like, I'm seeing the profits just with the two of us now. I'm like, this is good. Let's just keep going with this. But I do understand, like, you know, we only have so much bandwidth in our day. So we did hire someone. And then it just kept growing ever since, man. I don't even want to say it's due to luck or anything like that, but things always somehow worked out. But it's not an easy ride. It's such a roller coaster. Like the amount of stress. I mean, I have so many, I think, white hairs now due to this stress. But I mean, it comes with the territory, right? I knew what I was getting into. So far, so good. I don't want to jinx anything. I'm enjoying it so far. But is it stressful? Yeah, 110% stressful.
Where did the name Coastal Digital Group come from?
Okay, so nothing fancy here or anything like that. We just wanted to let people know that we can work coast to coast. The goal was to not just work for Toronto or Ontario and stay there, or even just in Canada. So we just, every continent has a coast. So we just kind of thought in that sense? If we were to ever get really big, what kind of name would resonate our desire to go global in a sense? So we thought, oh, we like that term, coast to coast. But what really solidified it? I liked the whole acronym thing at that time. I just wanted something like a three-letter acronym, like CDG, and people will just call us CDG. People just call us Coastal now, which is fine as well. Once my partner started showing like logos of waves and what could be done with this name as well, the rest is history. Like, we just fell in love with that name and we're like, that's what we're going to stay with.
What does the company look like today versus your first day of business?
First day of business at Coastal was primarily rich media production, design and production. So for the first year and a bit, that's all we would do. They would just come to us for rich media ads. We'd code them and that was it. So fast forward to today, I mean, and the pandemic had a lot to do with where we are today. So my business partner at the time when I worked with him, he was on the ad operations side of media. And one of the most talented ad ops guys you'll ever meet. So I figured, you know what, everything kind of paused when COVID happened in 2020. So we're like, you know what, we got to pivot. We got to figure something out. We have the expertise of ad operations, like the staff that we had at the time. Not only were they coders, but they were familiar with operations as well. So I said, why don't we try to make that a business, right? Like, that's a product. We have the knowledge. Sometimes when we give our clients ad tags to run their ads, there's a lot of troubleshooting involved, and it's usually with the trafficking team. So, you know, the ops team. So we were already teaching a bunch of these media vendors. I'm not going to name any names, but like a lot of Canadian media vendors who just weren't really familiar with custom ad tags and ad operations and et cetera, et cetera. So I just started by approaching one company, one of our clients, saying like, hey, what do you think about us kind of either training your current staff or doing your ad operations? Like, we'll just be your outsource partner. That actually saved us during the pandemic. So we landed three retainer clients on that front. And that kind of kept us going. And then we had... So we had AR, and I'm going to be going all over the place. Sorry, man.
No, it's all good. Go for it.
Yeah, we had AR as a product offering developed. Actually, you know what? Let me rewind back. So after doing rich media production, we were only using CMPs, creative management platforms, Celtra being the main one that we used. We thought to ourselves, hey, you know what? There's no one actually based in Canada who's created a creative management platform. So why don't we build our own from scratch, like literally code the entire program, similar to what you see today with Celtra or any of the ad builder platforms. So we went ahead and did that, tried the whole venture capitalist route and see what we could get there, worked with the Mars Discovery team and tried to figure out the best pitch for this creative management platform. We were pretty successful bootstrapping the whole thing to the point where we had a pretty decent product, and it's beta version. It basically worked. You could do what you needed it to do, but you know, the interfaces weren't as pretty or anything like that. Reporting wasn't down pat yet. It still had to be manual export. But regardless, we were on our way to actually building something that we really, really, truly believed in. And truthfully, it was our exit strategy. But then, you know what, things... we wanted to eventually incorporate other things that other CMPs didn't have, such as augmented reality and how to bring that into like a drag and drop builder style platform. That obviously was doing well, you know, with the whole Pokemon Go and Snapchat, like AR was becoming mainstream. I mean, everyone was playing Pokemon Go at that time. But fast forward to this product that we have, our CMP and incorporating AR. 2020 was supposed to be the year. We were in talks with a bunch of investors and we were going to go to that next round. And then COVID hit, literally like COVID hit, like maybe we were waiting to hear back from one of the investors. COVID hit like 2 weeks after and everything just paused. So, I mean, that's when, you know, we were like, all right, we got to figure stuff out now. Maybe ad ops is a thing. So, I mean, going back to your question, what do we do now? What does Coastal Digital Group look like now? This goes back to when I was describing us as, I'd like to coin it as like the experience agency. So again, not to be confused with full service marketing agencies, it's more so a well-rounded offering now, anything from creative design, production, rich media, I was mentioning videography. But I, during COVID or the pandemic, I also was big on like supporting local, like everybody else. I'm not unique or anything, but everyone wanted to support local. So I'm trying to figure out with the business that I currently have now, how can I support local with what I'm doing? So I started creating different partnerships with like local market research companies in Toronto, that, you know, what can I do with AR with other companies? So I created this AR by Out of Home network that recently launched and got a bunch of out of home vendors who have static inventory, and I'm utilizing them as like a new product offering. And, you know, that's where I kind of mean like this is an experience agency, because you can ask us for assistance with campaign planning, strategy, brand building, asset building, or anything to do with digital operations, trafficking, AR, gaming. Like, we can kind of do it all. I know a lot of people like to say, yeah, we can do it all. But I mean, I truthfully want to be that well-rounded offering to our industry.
So Taro, if anyone listening to this wants to get in touch with you to chat about opportunities with Coastal Digital Group, what's the best way to do it?
It would be email. So that's sotero@coastaldigitalgroup.com, sotero@coastaldigitalgroup.com.
I'm really enjoying our chat. You ready for rapid fire questions?
Sure, let's go.
The campaign you are most proud of?
I'd have to say it was a Grace Foods Canada hot pepper sauce campaign. Did a lot. That was our first, because I mean, I don't know if you're aware. I know it's supposed to be rapid fire, but I'm just going to say this anyway.
Go for it.
We're pretty much like a behind the scenes type of partner or agency, if you will, where we would be utilized by different media vendors across Canada. Like, there's so much work we've done that, not necessarily like I can't say that we've done it, but because we're representing our client, who is the one that's kind of dealing with that, either direct client or media agency, we're just the behind the scenes guys. So I don't, you know, I can't really say I'm most proud of those campaigns, even though we created some really, really cool interactive ads. But this one was the first one where we had not only the digital ads creation, we did the landing pages, we did the in-store decals, we hosted the contest, did an experiential marketing activation where it was a hot sauce challenge at Liberty Village. And there was just like blog TO hosts were recruited there. We had some influencers there. We had Virgin Radio was doing a live broadcast there. So it was a very well-rounded campaign. It was our very first one that I was a part of. So that's kind of what I'm most proud of. I like seeing it kind of from the digital and traditional side. Just a well-rounded campaign that I'm happy to be a part of.
Your favorite movie?
Gladiator. Russell Crowe, Gladiator.
If Hollywood were to make a movie based on your life story, who would you want to play you?
It's a toss-up, though. I'm going to say Kevin Hart, but Aziz Ansari is a hard second.
My follow-up to that, if Hollywood did make this movie based on your life story, what would we call it?
It might sound cheesy, but I'm going to say you'd call it Journey to Being a Good Person.
Your favorite book?
Oh, this is a good one. So my wife actually made me a custom book. And it was called Why I Love You, Some of the Very Many Reasons. So it's just such an adorable book. And it's not like an egotistical book where she's saying all these nice compliments about me, but it's just very personal. And like, it's just something I will always cherish.
Your favorite song?
Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen.
You ever heard the remake by Panic at the Disco?
No. Panic at the Disco?
Panic at the Disco did a cover of Bohemian Rhapsody for the first Suicide Squad film. It's fantastic. Wow. And I like the Queen edition.
Yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen is just my go-to karaoke song because I'm Filipino, so we love to sing. So it just takes you on a journey, right? Like, it has the slow tempo, the high, the opera style, like the rock and roll. It encompasses everything.
The best advice you've ever received?
Be nice to everyone. Because you never know if you'll cross paths with them again someday. And this was by our coordinators of the advertising media sales program. Shout out to Barb and Donna. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Barb and Donna, but there is a term at the time when I was at Cassette the term of Barb and Donna kids, and they even had a massive billboard.
I remember the billboard. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, are you a Barb and Donna kid?
I'm not a Barb and Donna kid, but I'm very familiar with it. I've worked with a lot of Barb and Donna kids.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the time, I think it was like maybe 50% of us were Barb and Donna kids employed in the industry. So it was just great company to be around. But yeah, when Barb and Donna told us stories about our industry and, you know, just basically be nice to everyone. And it does ring true to this day. So, I mean, it's good advice to have.
My signature closing question, if you weren't in media, what would you be doing and why?
I am big into cooking, so I know it's not the best investment per se, but I would like to open up little pop-up restaurants here and there, just fusion food. It could be anything again. But yeah, really short-term, short-lived restaurants all over like the world and different metropolises.
Sotero, this has been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.